A very warm welcome to Soundtrackin', my weekly podcast talking about film and music. My name's Edith Bowman. Thank you so much for being here with us. I appreciate your ears and your attention. I've got so many exciting things coming up for the podcast over the next couple of weeks, whether that be film club events or just generally being slightly giddy about the people that I've had the joy of chatting to. So I apologise in advance at my fangirling that is very evident when I listen back to the episodes. It's genuine enthusiasm that comes from a real place. So do you know what? I'm not going to apologise. I'm going to go back on that. I take it back. But anyway, thank you so much for listening. And I really, really appreciate you picking us out of the thousands of podcasts that are available to you. Our latest guest on Soundtrackin' is director Zack Snyder, joining me to discuss part two of Rebel Moon, entitled The Scargiver. It's up on Netflix now, so if you want to dive in, you can watch part one and part two back to back. It's about 4.5 hours, 5 hours. It follows on from the first installment of the saga and sees our heroine Cora and a band of warriors defend their homeland, Velt, against the tyrannical Motherworld. It's interesting kind of reading people's kind of reviews and all that kind of stuff and things. I tend to try and really avoid doing that because I'm the type of person who hates being told what to think about something before I've experienced it. There's lots of kind of people talking about, you know, kind of, oh, it's a Star Wars ripoff and all this kind of stuff. But as you hear Zack talk about, it's kind of who hasn't been influenced by Star Wars? And I love how he kind of just goes, you know, when I talk to him about the inspiration and the kind of where the idea came from, he's like, Star Wars, you know. So he's kind of, he's wearing his influences on his sleeve. Both installments of Rebel Moon are scored by Tom Holkenberg, aka Junkie XL. And we're going to begin with a cue from the second film from a rabble such as this.
How you doing?
I'm good. I'm Edith. It's a pleasure to meet you, sir.
It's nice to meet you.
I just had the pleasure of watching part two of this wonderful world that you've created for us to just lose ourselves in and fall in love with characters and hate people and kind of want to join kind of, you know, the best gang to be around sort of thing. There's so much in this show and in this film and in these worlds. So congratulations, first and foremost. I'm really interested as to what the genesis of starting this whole thing was for you. What was the kind of the initial inspiration to want to create these worlds and these characters and these stories and relationships?
Absolutely, it was Star Wars. I mean, if you really want to talk about origin. But I do think that, like, and maybe it's more clear when you see the extended versions or the director's cuts. And I've said this famously, but there's a magazine, Heavy Metal Magazine, that was printed. It still exists, but really through the 80s and 90s, well, really through the 80s, where I really was into it and watching it every day and reading it every day. Well, whenever I could get, you know, whenever it would come, because it was, you know, like I had a subscription. That really was a huge aesthetic influence on the movie and on like all the weirdness, you know what I mean? Like the one thing about heavy metal that was awesome was it really combined like sci-fi fantasy. It was sexy and it was violent, but it was also like had a slight like Twilight Zone quality. So everything was like, all the stories were really fantastical and you never knew where it was going to go. And it was very European, you know, it was like French, you know, feeling. So it's like that sort of Euro sci-fi thing, I think is really was a big influence on me.
One thing particularly around that whole kind of world, particularly around like the creature creation as well, and those kind of maybe the unique nature to specific characters and things, it almost kind of really pushed the boat out in that sort of side of things in terms of, you know, how kind of either grotesque something could be or how it could just be kind of out there with the kind of, you know, instead of limbs, whatever it has, you know, all that kind of stuff in terms of it kind of really pushed that side of it in terms of the, yeah, the kind of wild and crazy world of what you could create, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you know, I was really inspired by that, you know, the fantasy part of it. I mean, I think in this film, I think the incredible, one of the things that I think with time and as we made it and actually not really expecting that, you know, we planted that giant, all those fields of wheat and then we had to really harvest them and everything. I mean, I didn't sort of anticipate the real bond that we, and the real work it was to, because the actors really had to learn how to do that. And we had to really, we really cut down a tremendous amount of the wheat we planted. And it was really quite, you know, it was probably over the course of like a week of shooting that we harvested everything. It was longer than the real time, you know, 3 days to do it. It took us a week. You know, that was a part, you know, that's super grounded, you know, and super kind of real. And I think that that part was surprising in the context of this weirdo world to do something. And I mean, Sindri says it in movie one when he says, we believe that, you know, by doing this work by hand, that we're connected to the earth or whatever, to the land. And I think that that idea really rang true and it turned out to be like a real thing.
Yeah, it's almost like the further away they are from the kind of the earth, you know, when we see that lovely, at the very opening of the first film of when Korra, she's kind of with the earth and she's sort of smelling it and stuff like that. You know, it's almost the further that they get away from that, the kind of weirder it gets.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, and for Korra, of course, she's never really had that sort of connection to anything like that. You know, she doesn't take it for granted, I guess, is really that.
I want to talk really quite a lot about the music in it as well, but I just want to talk about that whole kind of silhouette of Anthony Hopkins' character. I love the silhouette of that. And it's so kind of artistic. Whenever he appears on screen, it kind of takes your breath away because there's something just so beautiful about that character, about how you've created him and the kind of accessories that we see on him at different points and things as well, you know, for people who haven't seen it. But I just think it's such a beautiful creation, both the character and how you present him to us.
Yeah, he's really like taken on a life of its own. And I feel like even in the sort of making of the movie, because we're doing like also like an 8-episode podcast, a dramatic podcast about the origins of the Jimmys.
Oh, wow.
They play as the story goes forward, you know, I'm not going to look. The Jimmys play, you know, a huge role in the movies, as well as I think that the idea of, well, when you see the, I hate to keep referencing the director's cuts, but just let me put it out there that the director's cuts of these movies, which come out in August, are 1 hour longer each. It's 6 hours total if you were to watch them together. And the Jimmy sequences in the first movie, you know, they sort of chronicle his sort of journey through the wilderness on Velt, like, you know, him finding his cape and finding those horns and all of that stuff and him kind of waxing poetic about like the nature of the universe and his place in it. And so I think that for lovers of Jimmy, that will be really fun. So that sort of explains his entire sort of getup, you know, when you see him, which sort of goes to what you were saying about his sort of final look, you know, with his crown and his cape. And I think, you know, and the whole thing for me was I was like searching for like a way to give him like this kind of organic nobility, you know, that feels like in his sort of return to the earth or to his origin, if you want to think about it in that way, or the why of his existence, he's kind of found in that quest some sort of humanity that he's lost, even though he's a robot. But you know, it's that idea. So we love Jimmy, and the other thing is, like, you know, when working with Tony in doing the voiceover, we had this guy Dustin on set who was, like, you know, 6'7", just super tall giant guy. You don't realize how tall Jimmy is. He's like super tall. It was cool though to show Tony sort of the finished scenes because he recorded it first. So before we shot the movie, we recorded it. So we had it on set, his voice.
Oh, wow.
And then after the movie was done, the scenes were shot, we did it again. So he had a second chance to kind of like go, oh, I see. Now I see the scene.
Yeah.
But I really wanted him as the sort of anchor base of the whole thing because he really, I mean, it's Anthony Hopkins, so.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you love that kind of, that opportunity as a creative to have kind of two versions, you know, talking about the director's cut of kind of going, you know, you've got the kind of, I guess, the sort of streamlined version, and then you've got the kind of like the bumper bonus pack. Do you like having the opportunity to do both of those things?
Every director's cut I've done in the past has been a reaction I've gotten from the studio. Like, oh, like the studio would say, oh, you can't have that in the movie, or the MPAA, or someone would say, like, we want to cut, you got to cut that out. And I would say, okay, well, you just made the director's cut have to exist because for me, whatever it is, that part of the movie is super important. And so in a lot of ways, now the movie that you're watching is not really what I'm intended. In this case, from the beginning, the Netflix, which I think is amazing that they did this, they said, look, we're known for your director's cuts. We've read your script. It's outrageous. There's things we're going to want you to like tone down, you know, for the mass audience, if you will. But we really want you to do your sort of original vision for this project alongside it so that we'll do the normal process where we give you notes and we talk about the scenes and we go to the MPAA and we talk about like what works best on the service and the whole way that, you know, they make a normal movie. That's the way the studios work. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but like the directors, they show a cut to the studio and the studio gives them notes about like, wow, we think this scene's too long. We think that scene's great. We wish you would get rid of that guy or anyway, whatever. And then you show it to an audience and then we get their notes, you know, and you use that process to whittle the movie down to what is released. Whittle, that's rude. You know, get it down.
Yeah. We know whittle. Whittle's good. Whittle it down is good, yeah.
Whittle it down. And so it's quite a process, you know? So for me, I mean, I wrote this crazy sci-fi movie and it's very weird and it was like long. It's very long. The script was like very like a Bible and as important as the Bible, I might add that. No, I'm just kidding.
It's cool. For you, reference. For sure.
Oh yeah, for me, it was more important than the Bible. No, I was pretty good. Anyway, so so we made all the cuts. Oh, also they were like, we'd really like the movies to be close to 2 hours because, you know, that's a good length for people to enjoy a film is 2 hours. And I was like, okay, great. All this is great. But then they were like, listen, we know you, we know what you love. Why don't you, alongside this movie, we're going to give you the money to do whatever the hell you want. Like, we're not going to give you any notes. We're not going to do anything. Just do what you want. Just do the movie that you wrote.
Wow.
And so that's what that is. That's what we did over on that side. So eventually, well, August, you'll be able to sit down and enjoy the 6 hours of that.
Can't wait, because that's also going to include a lot more of Tom's music as well, which is absolutely amazing because...
Two more hours of Tom's music.
You've built up this relationship from working with him on quite a number of projects now, sort of thing. But talk to me a little bit about how you sonically wanted this film. Because the great thing about creating something like this in this world is like obviously collaborating with someone like Tom, but then also you get to create the sounds of like the laser guns, all that kind of stuff, the sound design.
I have an incredible sound design team, Scott Hecker. I've worked with since Dawn of the Dead. Literally, he's worked on every one of my movies.
Wow.
I'm always, you know, we're always like, sound is a weapon. You know, like that's our thing we always say. And so he's amazing and like, you know, no shortage of creativity. And like, I'm a person who likes a lot of big sound effects. And so I'm constantly pushing those guys. And then my relationship with Tom and the way I work with Tom is that early on, I said, look, Tom, I want the music has to do two things. It has to evoke this sort of mythologically massive landscape. But within that story, there's going to be a lot of intimate and small kind of moments and themes. And I know it sounds contradictory, but that was sort of the directive I gave him. Was like, I want both. I wanted to be able to do both. The cool thing that Tom does, which I thought really was amazing, was he would, even when I was shooting, he writes suites, you know, like he'll write like a 15-minute suite, you know, that he'll say, okay, this is Welt, you know, this is the planet. What do you think? And it's just like a beautiful suite about 15 minutes of music that not linked to anything, just a vibe. I would give notes on it, but like he was really like, you know, and so he would do that for different, like, this is Noble's theme. This is, you know, and he was just so early in the process, he was sending me these amazing suites. And I would listen to him when I was going to work in the car. And it was really a great and sort of creative that, you know, he was in the DNA of the production. Because a lot of times the music comes way after, you know, and just kind of lands on top. Where I really felt like, for me anyway, he was really deep in it. And then Alison Krauss, who I've worked with in the past quite a bit, you know, she's from Nova Scotia, and she wrote all these kind of all the Celtic kind of like dance.
There's something quite special about the music that comes out of Nova Scotia. There's a great band called Winter Sleep. Similarly, like with Iceland, in terms of what that kind of environment sort of inspires and kind of, I don't know, it's in the water or something. I don't know.
It is. No, I think there's like it's weirdly like you can't escape nature, you know, I think. And so it can be a little bit. Yeah.
I love the Celtic dancing in the barn. That's so great. It's really, really being Scottish, I connected with that immediately. It is like you say, look, those two sort of extremes, you know, even that first, the first part when it opens, you have that beautiful score that opens with Cora. There's kind of these kind of voices. It's really delicate, almost with, you know, a little bit of violin and a bit of the voice and the guitar. And then you kind of almost flip right to the very end of part two, you know, and that kind of big anthemic kind of, you know, and the drums, and it kind of does everything on that journey almost.
Look, it's a difficult assignment in a lot of ways. I know that I can land over and over like crazy images, but he has to really kind of pull the strings that draws them together. For me, it's been fantastic.
Absolutely amazing. And that kind of air combat scene towards the end of part two as well, that's just extraordinary to kind of watch. And I love the cue through that as well, because, you know, it starts off with this kind of, with a battle almost, but then this kind of almost like sound of optimism kind of comes through the music as well. It's just, it's a really great way to emphasize how important the music is to storytelling and how music can be storytelling as well.
It's absolutely storytelling, and it absolutely is in our DNA and in our, like, it's in our most primordial, like, storytelling kind of language, you know, the music as a something that transports you couldn't be more important.
Have you got really important soundtracks that mean a lot to you in terms of, you know, even before you were making and creating, and you maybe had the idea that this was the world you wanted to go into, that were either pieces of music or scores that you kind of really connected to and highlighted to you the importance of music and storytelling?
Yeah, I really wear out the Philip Glass Mishima album. I listen to it constantly. It's on my record player. Actually, on my record player right now is Ghost Story. A Ghost Story. Do you know that movie?
Yes. Oh my God. David Lowery film. I love that. We had him on the podcast. I was obsessed with that song from it.
Yeah, I was too, but I am obsessed with that song.
Oh yeah. My God. What's it called again? That's going to really...
It's going to bug me too.
Yeah, it's going to bug me. I'm going to quickly find it. I was obsessed with that.
It's like right at the end of the A side of the album, you know, you kind of go through this and then it comes on and it you're like, all right, of course, this is a genius song.
And because he got the guys that were in the band that did that, then did the score as well. That's a great one.
That's on the record player right now.
I haven't listened to that in a long time, so I'm going to go and get that out today for sure.
David actually sent me that album, and I need to send him. I was going to send him, I have it. I just haven't put it in the mail. Is I have the Justice League box, you know, 7-disc box for Justice League, you know, all of Tom's Justice League music. If you've ever seen that box,
whoa,
yeah, it's like it's an amazing. The art alone is insane. Let alone the music is incredible, but the black box, you know, with like Darkseid and all the weird. It's just. They really did an amazing job on that album. I'm really happy with it.
I Get Overwhelmed is the song.
I Get Overwhelmed. That's it.
Yes. Are you running late? Did you see too much? All the awful dreams felt real enough. Did you know her then? She waking up? Did she die in the night? Leave you alone. Just emptiness, no place like home, just a fucking mess, mess. 20 messages, you hurt your thumbs, what a stupid game, getting nothing done. With your longest track, your highest score, while you crush your back. A minute before, I know we're going to run out of time and stuff, but just with that kind of, you know, with that world with like Justice League and kind of bringing together those worlds in terms of music, you know, in terms of bringing together those existing characters and worlds that have pieces of music attached to them and they don't, you know, there's a whole kind of circle of things that are already there. Do you kind of try and step away from that?
I think you do have to do that. That's why I don't, like when I'm with work with Tom, I don't give him any examples. I don't give him any, like, it's more theoretical, you know, like it's, and that's the great thing about him is he'll come with something really original, something I haven't, like, it's both, you know, it evokes, but it doesn't borrow. And so you feel like, especially for a world like this, it's like a wholly original experience. You want the music to also do the work of the images as well. So of course it's hard to do because, you know, there's so many incredible soundtracks and so many incredible movies. The great thing is we can, because Tom's and I have worked together so much, we will often put, if we're going to put temp music on, we use music that we've used in the past that he and I have made.
Yeah, that's great.
Because it's been my experience in the past, I just fall in love with like a track. You know, like in Watchmen, that's the Philip Glass track. We just couldn't get it off the movie. I just was like, okay, let's just go license it because I can't get it off. We put it on just for, you know, when we were editing.
Thank you. mean, that's a great example of kind of that, what, you know, what a film that works so well with that combination of Tyler's score, but then also those needle drops, you know, and some films warrant that, some films don't. And that just worked so great, that marriage of those two music worlds.
It really just was so weird. Yeah, Tyler did an amazing job. And by the way, he had to navigate all that insanity. And I think that, and the needle drops and all that. I mean, because, like, for instance, you know, Times They Are Changing, we got the original stems for that song because we had to extend it, right? And so Dylan sent us the original stems. It was like insane.
Oh my God.
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone, or the times they are a-changing.
Simon and Garfunkel song, what is it? Sound of Silence. They never let people use that song, you know, be in a movie. So, like, it was this crazy. The music we got for that movie is unbelievable. It was crazy.
How did you do it then? How did you get Simon Garfunkel?
The property is so beloved, you know, like Watchmen, the graphic novel, and just they really, in both cases, they were like, yeah, for Watchmen, yeah. And we were like, what? Okay, cool. Like, I thought for sure they'd say no, but like, those are also all referenced in the graphic novel.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence.
These first two parts that we get of this, you know, going back to Rebel Moon, you know, the ending of part two, it's a clear setup for another film, which I very much hope you've at least written. 3 and 4 or just 3? What are we talking? How far are we ahead?
We have an outline that gets us, that would get us all the way, you know, to our goal.
12?
What that? Oh, yeah, exactly. And then beyond that, I don't know. But, you know, if Belisarius is still in power on MOA and, you know, spoiler alert, there's someone else around that we need to track down, like, and if the idea would be to have a coup, that's a complicated affair. There's a lot of distance between where we are right now and that eventuality. And so, yeah, that's kind of where I think we're headed. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff that has to get done to get there. Who knows?
And in between that, we've got the director's cut, we've got the graphic novels, we've got the podcast, we've got all this amazing additional stuff, which is
an animated film. So yeah, there's a lot of. Yeah.
Wow. Great. I can't wait. It's so great to get the chance to chat to you, Zach. And I feel like we just, you know, scratched the surface when it comes to this amazing relationship and appreciation that you have for how important music is to the storytelling and the world that you create and you're involved in. So really, I really, really appreciate your time today. It's great to chat to you. Thank you.
Oh, awesome to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thanks, Zach.
To Rebel Moon Part 2, The Scar Giver, that's Enemy of the Sun by Junkie XL. aka Tom Holkenberg, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtrackin' with Zach Snyder. My huge thanks to Zach and the team for arranging that and giving up his time to talk to me. As I said, both Rebel Moon films are available to watch right now on Netflix. Zach's enthusiasm for his craft is really infectious. You know, when you look at that kind of back catalogue of what he's worked on, how much he's kind of been involved in worlds that have existed, it's kind of really interesting to think about how much of it of his own he's kind of been allowed to inject. And just hearing him talk about director's cuts and stuff, he's a geek in a nicest possible way, and I just really enjoyed chatting to him. And I think it's one of those instances where I pretty much could have asked him one question and he could have well talked to me about it for days, which I would have quite happily let him do had we not had a limited time. If you want to hear my chats with the aforementioned Junkie XL and the wonderful David Lowry, or indeed any of the other 425 odd episodes, head to wherever you get your podcasts. And what we'd really appreciate is if you could leave us a rating and a review when you get there. It's really, really appreciated. Also, spreading the word about the podcast if you like what you hear. You can follow us on our socials. We're at Soundtrackin' UK, and please check out our YouTube channel too. We've just stuck up that brilliant conversation with Noomi Rapace, who was a joy to chat to. And if you haven't checked out her show on Apple TV, it's called Constellation, then you really must. Next up, if anybody does follow me on social media, then they will have seen on Thursday night how giddy I was at the reality of getting to chat to Luca Guadagnino. His third sitting on Soundtrackin', woohoo! The Luca hat-trick. Now, this was kind of really touch and go as to whether we were going to be able to get time with Luca. He actually hasn't done loads for his new film Challengers, which is not because he doesn't have a 1,000,000% belief in this film. He's kind of really allowed those three main stars, Zendaya, Mike Feist and Josh O'Connor, kind of take the lead on promoting the film. But I tried and I pushed and I kept hounding his team, thanks Catherine and Lindsay, to give me some time with him, because the score that he's worked on with Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross is absolutely brilliant. It's pounding, it's ravey, and it's really complemented as well by lots of needle drops that you'll hear Luca talk about on next week's podcast. So make sure you join me then for our third installment with Luca Guadagnino talking about Challengers, which is out in cinemas on the 26th of April. So on Friday, make sure you get your tickets and get along to see it, and then follow us and listen to next week's episode with Luca. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.